Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and if you're just joining us, we're listening to American Spying Then and Now, which includes Andrew Basevich, Stephen Kinzer, Evan Thomas, and is moderated by Brian Bender. Basevich.
My answer would be fear. I mean, when the American people are afraid, they wish to throw authority to the chief executive, believing that the chief executive is going to keep them safe. And in tandem, therefore, they wish to see the Congress to some degree marginalized. In the early Cold War, whether rightly or wrongly, Americans were afraid of communism. And therefore, the onset of the Cold War led to a massive expansion of the authority of the executive in a variety of ways. And we ought, frankly, to understand that, even if we don't approve of it. Remember what happened after 9/11. We were afraid. And we wished to see President George W. Bush act forcefully to keep us safe. And the Congress responded by passing the Patriot Act, which nobody understood what the contents were. Nobody understood the implications. But passing the Patriot Act, empowering the president, was supposedly going to keep us safe. I think something of the same dynamic was in play in the early years of the Cold War.
Kinzer.
There was an effort in the mid-1950s to rein in the CIA from Congress, to create what we would now call House and Senate Intelligence Committees. The person who sponsored it was Senator Mike Mansfield. He became suspicious and unhappy at a number of reports that he was hearing about the CIA, and he proposed a bill to create a congressional committee to oversee the CIA. He had 24 co-sponsors in the Senate, so a fairly substantial number. Eisenhower was completely opposed to this, perhaps for the reasons that Evan has pointed out. He fought it tooth and nail. He made sure that it didn't pass. And then, as one of the excuses that he gave to the senators in order to sway them away from voting for this bill. He said that he was going to name one of his old pals, General Jimmy Doolittle, who led the famous Doolittle raid on Tokyo during World War II, to have a study commission to study the CIA. And this is exactly the commission to which Evan referred. It produced this report complaining about Allen Dulles and the way that he ran the agency, but it had one recommendation that General Doolittle considered so sensitive, he didn't want to write it in the report, even though the report itself was highly classified. And that was a recommendation that he gave directly to Eisenhower, and that was, you should fire Allen Dulles. And this is when Eisenhower came back with this response. It takes a strange kind of genius to run an agency like this, and I'd rather have Allen Dulles than anyone else I know. From that decision stemmed a lot of trouble.
To pick up on Andy's comment about fear, obviously, by definition, intelligence operations are supposed to be geared towards the perceived threat. Evan talked about the spread of communism at the beginning of the Cold War driving this entire system. I was wondering if we could fast forward to today, obviously a very different set of perceived threats, much more diffuse, perhaps many more in number, whether it's global terrorism or Islamic extremism, choose your term, perhaps rising states like China that are perceived as threats in the future, and a host of other things, even climate change, is something that the CIA actually has analysts that focus on. Tell us a little bit just how the changing nature of the threat, at least in your view, is changing or has changed the approach of American intelligence. Obviously, there's more oversight. Presumably, there's more oversight now than there was at the beginning of the Cold War. But I'm curious your views on whether the fundamentals are still very similar, or with the end of the Cold War and this different set of actors, has it changed?
Thomas.
I remember in the early 90s, was a low period for the CIA because there was no one big threat. There were a lot of threats. Drugs, terrorism was on the radar, but not to the degree that it became. Economic collapse. I mean, there was a long laundry list of things that could go wrong around the world. But the CIA became demoralized because they didn't know what to focus on. They were being pulled in a lot of different directions, but in no one clear direction. And they felt that they, because they had no big threat, they were losing clout. The head of the CIA was no longer briefing the President of the United States in the morning. The CIA felt shut out, demoralized, the funding was less. And they were happy when 9/11 came along and gave them a big threat, one big threat that they could focus on. Their funding went way back up. They became essential to the President again. They became important and significant. And that has lasted. I mean, although there are moves now to take the drones away from them and give them to the military, you probably know more about this than I do and how that's going. But my perception is the CIA is happy when there's a single threat that the whole country's focused on. And when it becomes diffuse, that's a problem for them.
Inzer.
I would also add that the CIA has changed so dramatically. It used to be the intelligence agency of the United States. Now it's one of a whole number, and its importance in relative terms has definitely declined. Now, it's not just the decline of the CIA and its replacement by other agencies. We've also seen something that we never saw before, which was this spectacular rise in the private contractors that are involved in our security apparatus. We have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people with top security clearance who don't work for the U.S. government. They're private contractors. We have huge numbers of firms, names and identities and purposes of which are unknown to the public, which are deeply involved in our security apparatus. We've created a whole new part of government, which is under a rubric of private contractors, that's carrying out a host of operations around the world that the American public knows nothing about. So I would say that the level of oversight may have increased in terms of institutions, but in real terms, I'm not sure that anybody who has a truly skeptical view of this burgeoning security establishment is in a position to offer any effective oversight.
Basevich.
Well, I think you're both making a very important point in terms of contrast. A difference between the present era and the early Cold War that we were talking about before. And that is that in the early Cold War, national security institutions were relatively small, very young, finding their way, Over the course of the Cold War, they came to be massive, influential, and as Evan suggested, very much committed to doing whatever is necessary to sustain their own status, importance, and budget share. That is the apparatus, orders of magnitude larger than it was back in the 1950s, that we turn to say, help us to understand the world and the direction of events. And this is an apparatus that wishes to have a big enemy, that wishes to define the world in security terms, in terms of threats. Now, I'd be the last person to argue that there are no threats, there are no security concerns. There certainly are. But if that's your frame of reference, it becomes very difficult then to imagine a different world, and therefore to create an intelligence picture that may broaden the range of basic policy options beyond what we tend to get, which is that the world poses a threat and we need to arm ourselves and be ready to respond.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
I woke up this morning and I turned on the news. It was a Sunday morning, they were sitting in the pews. The doctor's wife was in the choir. She was about to sing. She saw it all in front of her, and she heard that awful ring. In the name of God, he held his pistol pointed at the doctor's head. In the name of God, he pulled the trigger. Now the doctor's lying dead. Dr. Tiller had a family, three daughters and a son. Two girls were both doctors who believed in what he'd done. They knew someone had to do something before they leave this world behind. If it wasn't them, then who would serve the cause of womankind? In the name of God, he held his pistol pointed at the doctor's head. In the name of God, he pulled the trigger. Now the doctor's lying. This is not Afghanistan, it's the heartland, USA, where a girl has to wonder if she'll get acid in her face, where they bomb the women's clinics because the preacher told them to, where the man there on the TV told them that's what they should do. In the name of God, he held his pistol pointed at the doctor's head. In the name of God, he pulled the trigger. Now the doctor's lying dead. In the name of God. In the name of God.
And now, back to American Spine, Then and Now, with Bacevich, Kinzer, Thomas, and Bender. Thomas.
To maybe delve into this a little bit further, there's, I would say, two kinds of oversight. On the one hand, determining whether the intelligence operations, covert operations themselves, are actually successful or working or achieving the stated aims. And then the second, perhaps, determining whether the activities are abusing, for example, civil liberties, if these secret agencies are going too far, not just in spying on foreigners, perhaps allies as well, but also American citizens. And maybe we can delve into that a little bit more in terms of how confident are we that there is a system in place to prevent the abuse of some of these powers on American citizens. Now, of course, during the Cold War, you had a very significant domestic component to that. fear of communists, not just in the U.S. government, but groups that might be sort of seen as a fifth column. Lots of files have come out, including in this library, about J. Edgar Hoover's FBI and what they were doing domestically. But then, of course, today we hear every day in the newspaper about the National Security Agency and this gathering of bulk telephone data, emails. Obviously, technology has changed, and many more Americans' information can be gathered than ever before. And maybe we can have a little conversation about how things have changed on the domestic front, Cold War versus post 9/11, and any concerns that you have that there is not enough checks on the domestic component of intelligence gathering.
Thomas.
One thing you have to step back on and talk for a second about the limitations of intelligence. I mean, in working on the books I've worked on, I've always been struck by the gap between the movie version of intelligence that we all take in, spies running around doing great things in James Bond books or movies, and what presidents sort of wished intelligence would be able to do. Presidents go to these movies, too. And the reality on the ground, which is very limited, and the human intelligence, spying, traditional spying, has a pretty, at best, a spotty record. In the 1950s, we basically failed to penetrate the Soviet Union. We had some walk-ins, some memorable walk-ins who told us some stuff, but we, our spies weren't learning that much. And human intelligence is, it's necessary, it's important, but it hasn't been that productive. We rely a lot on foreign intelligence services, so-called liaison relationships, where basically we're getting our stuff not from our own spies, but from Jordanian spies or Egyptian spies or Saudi spies. Their methods of getting that information we don't necessarily even want to ask about, and or whether how reliable it is. So there's a real limit on human intelligence. So what are we going to do? If human intelligence doesn't work, technology, that is something we're good at and have always been good at, and it's something where our intelligence services have a more impressive record, the U-2 spy plane, the spy satellites, at least being able to look down and see what weapons the Soviet Union has, and over time the ability to listen in on people and to break codes. Now that's something that we're good at. So there's a natural technological impulse. If you can't get the intelligence through spies, the kind of spies you see in the movies or 24 or whatever, but you can get it by listening in through and crunching data, there's a natural impulse to go down that road, and I think that's what happened. There was a period, actually, the NSA was afraid that it was going to go blind because it couldn't crack codes. Well, they got over that, and they were able to take in all this data and to data mine, and that was very appealing to them. Well, the only problem with that is that the data that they were mining was our phone numbers.
Ginzer.
I think one of the biggest changes that's happened in intelligence since 9/11 is the amount of it that's now focused inside the United States. We've had this view develop in recent years that the threat is all around us. I noticed that when John Kerry spoke to the correspondents' dinner in Washington, he thanked all the correspondents for coming, and he said, it's nice to be able to put some faces to the metadata. Now, I used to live in Germany. I covered the revelations about the Stasi. One of their problems was that they knew everything about everybody, but they knew so much that they couldn't read it. They couldn't process all this information. Now we have electronic means to gather so much information. I think we're sucking up huge amounts, much more than we ever can process. The only value of it, I think, could be to be able to look back on it after something has happened, but I don't think it has much predictive value. I was kind of interested to read the other day that no less a figure than Jimmy Carter has said that whenever he has something private to say, now he won't send it in an email, he sends it in an envelope with a stamp. And my proposal is that the U.S. Postal Service use this as a promotion. No one will read your mail. You go back to using stamps.
Basevich.
Yes, but even though they're clapping, they won't. And this gets, I think, to Evan's point about the American affinity for technology. When some new gee whiz technological development appears on the scene, our tendency is to fall in love with it, to see it as a solution to all of our problems, and only then to discover 30 or 40 years later that there actually is a downside. I remember as a kid, way back in the 1950s, Adams for Peace, the Eisenhower administration promoting the development of nuclear power because this was going to provide not just us, but the world, infinite amounts of cheap energy. I don't remember people talking about what happens when the reactor blows up or if a tsunami sweeps across the reactor. And, oh, by the way, what are you going to do with all the atomic waste that's generated? That discovery came later. Decades before, Americans fall in love with an automobile. Everybody wants to have a car. This is the true expression of freedom. Only 30 or 40 years later do we begin to appreciate the way this love affair with the automobile transforms the American way of life in massive ways, many of which just aren't all that good. So here we are. We're now in the information age. Certainly the kids that I teach at Boston University are in love with their smartphones. And everything about their smartphones, they believe, is the source of entertainment, happiness, fulfillment, and making friends. And there's I think, an unwillingness to think about the downside of that technology that gives us our smartphones. And some of that downside has to do with this massive collection and intrusive collection capability that's now in the hands of the government. And it's going to take 30 or 40 years, I'm sorry to say, before we're willing really to take on board what is some of the downside of the information revolution.
Ye come here, gather round the stage. The time has come for us to voice our rage against the ones who've trapped us in a cage to steal from us the value of our wage. From underneath the vestiture of law, the lobbyists at Washington do gnaw. At liberty, the bureaucrats guffaw. And until they are purged, we won't withdraw. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. Our nation was built upon the right of every person to improve their plight. The laws of this republic they rewrite, and now a few own everything in sight. They own it free of liability. They own that they are not like you and me. Their influence dictates legality. And until they are stopped, we are not free. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. You enforce your monopolies with guns while sacrificing our daughters and sons. But certain things belong to everyone. Your thievery has left the people none. So take heed of our notice to redress. We had little to lose, we must confess. Your empty words do leave us unimpressed. A growing number join us in protest. We occupy the streets, we occupy the courts, we occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. You can't divide us into sides, and from our gaze you cannot hide. Denial serves to amplify. And our allegiance you can't buy. Our government is not for sale. The banks do not deserve a bail. We will not reward those who fail. We'll not move till we prevail. We'll occupy the streets. We'll occupy the courts. We'll occupy the offices of you. Till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. We'll occupy the streets. We'll occupy the courts. We'll occupy the offices of you. Till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. We are the many, you are the few.
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.